419, Chapter 26 of The Count of Monte Cristo. Book talk begins at 1824.
Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from where the Delaware River meets the Old York Road, New Hope, Pennsylvania. Episode 419, A Bouncing Baby Boy. This episode of Craftlit is brought to you by its listeners. Many thanks and much gratefulness to all of the listeners who have gone over to patreon.com/craftlit and pledged their support to the show. We couldn't do it without you. Thank you. Well, hello. It is so good to be back in front of a microphone, which is not to say that I didn't get to play with a few microphones with my brother-in-law when I was in Syracuse, but mostly I got to play with my little nephew. He is so adorable. It was very hard to come home, but home I am and back to the Count of Monte Cristo with you. Now, I have a little bit of crafty chat for you. And I also have a little bit about Paris for you. And we have a really, really good chapter. And it's also a long one, which means I wasn't able to put the second chapter that ties in directly to this chapter in here today. And I apologize for that in advance, but it just means that we have something to look forward to for next week. So that is where we stand. So before we get anywhere else, let's listen to a little bit of crafty chat from this week's YouTube live stream, and then we'll move along. And this week, Dawn had a child emergency, so our best wishes go out to Dawn. And as a consequence, you'll just hear Erica and me on this week's crafty chat.
So kind of crafty stuff have you been collecting for the last 2 weeks while I've been out babysitting?
Okay, well, let's see here. I finished the gray thing.
Yeah, that is pretty.
For those listening at home, it's a half circle pie shawl, garter based lace out of a superwash sock yarn that's just lovely. And the pattern is out with the tester now. And I was supposed to get it to the, just remembered, I was supposed to get it to the tech editor yesterday.
Whoops.
But I'm not sure exactly how soon the pattern's going to be out because I'm waiting for the yarn dyer to list the yarn. She doesn't have it listed on Ravelry yet. I haven't found any way you can buy it since I bought it from Yarn Over Truck at Stitches. So it'd be kind of silly to specify an unavailable yarn, so I'm waiting for that to become available.
Right.
Then just because I was itching to cast something on, because of course, you know, all my lingering whips are not enough, I cast on just a plain non-lace half circle pie shawl.
Right.
And I don't know, probably can't see.
I can see dots of light, pinpoints of light, but I can't see much detail.
Yeah, the color isn't going to show in there, but it's my black, purple, and red gradient.
Oh, cool.
And so the black isn't really a solid black. You can kind of see purple bleeding through. Let me try holding this up again.
I love that. Yeah. There's the purpley red, because I'm seeing the blue. I think I'm seeing the blue as a purple, and
it's purple and red. Yeah, it's black, purple, and red.
I can see the black in the middle now. That's beautiful.
And it's from Fresh from the Cauldron. It's their superwash gradient, and the color is called Exsanguinate.
What a perfect name.
An awesome, awesome name.
Cool.
I love showing this to people and seeing their different reactions. But one guess what this is.
That looks like a braid of hair.
Mm-hmm.
That's your husband's beard?
Yes, it is.
Oh, my good God. Oh, my. Wow. How long is that thing?
Quite. I think the longest bit is about 10 inches. I mean, it looks like a dead animal. It's just, you know, especially if you hold it this way, it looks like a rat or something. It's gross. But Sarah has always hated since he grew his beard, and he was ready to be done with it. So we decided for a very special graduation gift, the morning of her graduation, she got to cut off his beard. So,
oh, wow.
He filmed it. We filmed it and everything. I braided it and she cut it, and then he, you know, trimmed and shaved and all that good stuff. But so we're now in discussions on what to do. He hasn't been ready to part with it yet. So it sits on the desk wrapped in a paper towel because the kids are completely grossed out by it, which is, you know, leads to some fun right there because we're just cruel as parents. But there's been much discussion about what to do with it. Now, because the staple length is really long. So there has been much joking about, and I do have a drum carder about carding it in with some wool and knitting something out of it. And oh my gosh, you should have heard the kids screaming at the idea. They just were so completely freaked out and repulsed and against it, and which of course just makes me want to do it more,
right?
And not tell them until, you know, I've made something that they like. And I like Tara's idea to frame it and hang it next to her graduation tassel. We had thought about putting it in a little shadow box.
Yeah do it with her tassel and her graduation diploma.
Or mounting it like you do a deer head or a fish or something, you know, mount it and then, you know, killed by Sarah Hernandez on May 26, 2016.
Oh my God.
So
that's awesome.
That was our big thing. So that was about 2.5 years worth of beard. So, God.
And then I also received this.
Oh my goodness.
Yes. This is incredible.
So I'm breaking in here for a moment because I received so many wonderful birthday gifts from listeners. And I showed several of them on the YouTube video. And one of them I misplaced the card for, and I didn't have the name of the knitter. The knitter was longtime listener Irina, who knitted the most amazing black, it's like a double knit cowl that has all of the names of all of the books we've ever done on Craftlit knitted into it in a graduated multicolored yarn. So you've got a black background with this fantastic rainbow colored book titles going down the scarf. It is amazing. And I wish I could just send you all a postcard of it, but the picture of it is on the show notes at craftlit.com/419, and you really should go take a look at it. So you're going to hear Erica's response to seeing that, and then you'll hear a little bit more about it.
Because it's all of our books, all of them. This is a double knit cowl, and it's so cool. All of our books are there, and she used the variegated color, so it goes all the way through the rainbow, all the way around as you go around the thing. And
wow,
I thought that was amazing. And you know, the card was all, wow, you're so not going to be able to wear this right now, but I'm taking it to Paris is what I'm doing. I'm going to represent, man, because that's awesome.
That's cool.
And if it weren't 1,000 degrees in here right now, I would absolutely have it on. But I didn't think dying of heat prostration was a particularly good thing to do on a film. So
no, then not good.
AT went to a Renaissance festival, and she, because she listens and seems to know my boys well, she got them these little, they're leather bound.
They look like little journals.
Yes. They are leather bound. They are acid free handmade paper, and they're bound in leather. And the boys immediately started going, ooh, I could do this, or I could do this. And Thing Too, who is there with his glasses on, he immediately started to write a song, which he has in his journal
nice.
Already. He's trying very hard to be a good songwriter, and he's doing a nice job. They are being crafty in their crafty journals. So, AT, thank you for that. That's really awesome. And they were so excited. This is from my aunt.
Raven.
I remember, like, way back when we first started doing our crafty chat, I shared a little wallet that she had made me where she just reverse engineered a wallet, and she did it out of book material. And she wrote to me.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. This is her again. She said,
"Hello, I made a bag for you. I made things for the babies in Syracuse, and I wanted to make something for you too. It isn't your fault you had your kids before I retired and started to make stuff. So, here you go." And she said, "I tried to find some Madame Defarge themed fabric, but this Nevermore print was the closest I could find. It's designed by Gillian Foulard, and she cut out the edge of the fabric, the selvage edge. And so it's the Nevermore collection, designed by Gillian, G-I-L-L-I-A-N, Foulard, F-U-L-L-A-R-D, and it's London Portfolio is the name of
that's really cool.
The company. Yeah, so that's awesome. And I tried to take a picture where you could see that she not only did such a nice job with the fabric and all of that, but that it's fully lined and it has zippered pockets, one on each side. And it's huge. This could easily be, well, it's going to be a fantastic knitting bag, but it could easily be an overnight bag. You could just...
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
And it's got nibs. There are nibs on it, which I love too. So I have the coolest aunt.
Yeah. Well, cool aunties beget cool aunties, right?
The last thing that I have to share, because I haven't been able to do anything except rock a baby. Recover from not having a voice and rock a baby, is I found an app on the iOS store for Zentangles. And you have to pay to comment or like or respond in any way to the Zentangles, and you can't upload your own Zentangles unless you pay. It's like $2.99 a month, and I haven't been interested in paying for it. I just love looking at these and then occasionally taking a screenshot like this. I have never seen a Zentangle like that before.
That's pretty amazing.
Isn't that amazing? Let me see if I can get in a little closer too, because that level of detail is just wild. And normally people don't Zentangle quite that colorfully, but there was another one and everybody was saying, "Oh my gosh, who invented that kind?" Because they hadn't seen it before. Like I hadn't seen it before. And evidently it is a Zentangler, and I saved the name of her website, but she developed this, what somebody referred to as a surefire way to shade, color, add sparkle to this gemstone idea. Because it's really tricky to do that with watercolors or any other way. It's really
That's pretty amazing.
That sparkle. And boy, yeah, and there were a bunch of these. This was the one that I liked the best. But I thought that might inspire some of you as well to take a look at the Zentangly thing. And you can see, now that we've got a good one up here, you can see how really, really simple the repetition is. And you can also see, like, if you look underneath, or you look at the edge of the bezel on the green gem and the little flower burst below it, if you look at it closely, you can see lines don't match, they don't touch each other, or they go too far, or they overlap kind of wonky, and it doesn't matter. It just is. It just is low stress and relaxing, and I really have come to appreciate that in life, because life... So wow, I was very excited by those. And now I'm thinking, oh, when am I going to find time? I want to find time to go Zentangle.
So it's kind of funny to come back together on the YouTube live stream after being gone for 2 weeks. There's so much we had to catch up on. I hadn't really realized how much I have come to rely on, depend on, look forward to the Crafty Chats with Dawn and Erica, and how much I save of what's going on in my life to show, to present, to share on those live streams. So we were kind of bouncing all over the place, but it was fun and it was so good to see everyone. And we got to see all the people in the chat window and say hi and answer their questions. And it was a lot of fun. So one of the things that I said while we were on the live stream together was how great craftlit people are. Just in general, this is not news. This is something I've been saying for 10 years. But it is a fairly important thing to note that we have a self-selecting group of people who keep their hands busy, for the most part, and love classic literature, or at least interested in getting to know classic literature a little bit better. And that, I think, is a marvelous subset of humanity. I think we prove that all the time. But I also think that blends into why Diane has chosen some of the places that she has chosen for us to go to and visit in Paris. And one of those places is Montmartre. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with this area of Paris, think Hemingway, Fitzgerald, think Midnight in Paris, actually. Think interesting, quirky West Village during the Jazz Age in New York. That kind of vibe, that kind of feel. And then stop thinking about that and start thinking about the fact that none of those people can afford to live in the West Village in New York anymore. And none of those people can afford to live in Montmartre there anymore either. This is what happens. People go in, you know, the adventurous people, they go into a place, they make it livable, interesting, quirky, fun, and then they're pushed out because the rents go up. This is the way of the world, sadly. But it's also what gives rise to theater, like Rent, because those were the people who got pushed out of the West Village over into the East Village and eventually into Alphabet City in New York City. Similar things happened in Paris as well. But, much like the West Village, there are places left behind that are still quirky, funky, interesting, lovely. And I found a really, really wonderful website. It's called a walking tour of Montmartre. And the whole point is that if all you do is go look at the church up on the top of the hill and walk by all the peep shows at the bottom of the hill and say, wow, I was there. You were there physically, but you didn't really get a chance to see what it was and find these little hidden gems that are still there. So I've linked to that walking tour because we have some time on our tour where we can go off and explore on our own or in groups with each other. It doesn't matter, but the opportunity is there. And again, it's one of those things that Diane builds into her tours that makes me so happy to be able to offer something like this to you, is she knows what we like. She is one of us. And that pressure that I'm always so nervous about in going out with groups, that pressure to always be lockstep with everybody else. And now we're all going to go and do this thing. So everybody, let's go do this thing together. There is none of that on a tour with Diane. There's none of that on a tour with us. Because that isn't who we are. I get the sense that a lot of us are extroverted introverts. Extroverted in that we are perfectly comfortable talking to each other and having a good time. But introverts in that many of us need to recharge our batteries by having a little bit of quiet time to ourselves. I don't think we would be the readers we are if we didn't recharge that way, at least to a certain extent and sometimes. And it's nice to have that respected when you go on a vacation with other people. So Montmartre is the next stop on our little travelogue of our Paris tour. And if you are interested in finding out more, please don't hesitate to call Diane at Holiday Vacations 1-800-826-2266. Well, today for Chapter 26, there are just a couple of things to go over beforehand. I'm finding that that seems to be kind of the MO with Count of Monte Cristo, that there isn't so much I need to do before, but there's a lot of fun stuff to talk about after. Now, the first thing that I wanted to mention is something that I posted on the Facebook group. So if you're not on the Facebook group, you probably didn't see this go by. I've created a map for locations that are mentioned in The Count of Monte Cristo. This map is an editable map. That means you are more than welcome to go and add to this map. Right now, I have it set up very simply with just regular old pins, but one of the nifty things that you can do in editing these Google Maps is to change the pins to be representative of what we're talking about. So if, for example, we pin a location where somebody lives, you could change the little pin icon to a house icon, that kind of thing. I haven't gone down that rabbit hole because mostly I just wanted to get the ball rolling on the map and then hand it over to either you who are interested in geography or you who have homeschooling students who are listening to the book and want them to practice their latitude and longitude, because that is part of this map. You don't have to know latitude and longitude, but recognizing it so that you can utilize those numbers is a bit of a help, the way that this map interacts with we humans. So, part of the reason why I bring it up is because today, geography matters. We are moving away from Marseille, and we are moving into Provence, and there are many place names mentioned in today's chapter. And early on, one of the things that you will hear actually relates directly to Three Men in a Boat, our premium book right now, that canals started to become very important during this time period for travel and especially for commerce. These are the kind of canals where you would have a barge and a towpath, a walking path on the side, where you could literally physically tow a barge. Often there were mules that were involved in this. Sometimes it was just humans who were being used as mules to tow the barges along. Either way, the canal system was there, it was growing, it was important, and it was thriving. There's some wonderful websites that I found on the French canal system, and specifically the one on Rhône, which was the one that we are talking about today. So if you're interested in learning more, there is a link on the show notes at craftlit.com/419. Another thing that is mentioned early on is the Pont du Gard. Now, you have seen this. I know you've seen this. Even if you didn't know what it was when you saw it, you saw it. It's not really a valley. It's kind of like a very gently sloped, sided ravine, gully. I mean, it's big, it's significant, but it's not a valley in that it is vast, like the Hudson River Valley, nor is it a valley in the way that you might imagine a tributary to the Grand Canyon being a valley in that it is steep, sided, and deep. This is wide and broad, and there is water at the bottom of it. But importantly, the Pont du Gard is the aqueduct that was built to traverse this particular stretch of valley-ishness. It is important because it is beautiful and awe-inspiring and three stories tall. And this is why you've seen it before, is because the architecture on this sucker is so incredible. The lowest level of this structure has big arches, lovely, beautiful. The next level up has slightly smaller arches, and the top level has very little arches. And this is built by the Romans. This sucker is old, I mean old, and it never fell apart. If you've been to Rome and you've seen things like the Colosseum, then you've seen the side of the Colosseum that is extant and looks solid, and I don't want to say modern because it doesn't look like modern architecture, but modern in that it looks like a building that has been built and hasn't been destroyed, damaged over time. If you look at the Colosseum from the other side, you can see where all the damage is and how the thing just fell into disrepair. And it's very sad, but it's kind of important to see the effect of the passage of time. You can't see the effect of the passage of time on this baby. And part of that is because it wasn't just an aqueduct that was in use. Plenty of aqueduct structures got destroyed or lost. It was kept in use because it was a toll road as well as an aqueduct. A lot of the aqueducts were covered, unlike the California Water Project. These aqueducts were covered, and when they went across these ravines, you could walk along the top instead of having to swim along the top. Because the Romans, no dummies, clearly had figured out evaporation. And if you want your water to get from one place to another, you should probably put a lid on it. So it is an incredible structure and well worth going and taking a look at. I've linked to several pages on the show notes, so go take a look and then listen to the chapter. You'll see why. We'll talk about it after. The plagues of Egypt are referred to kind of obliquely, but just as a reminder, these were 10 plagues. They were sent to Egypt when they wouldn't let the Hebrew workers go. This is the "let my people go" origin. And several of the plagues blighted crops. There were different variations on it. Plagues of locusts and several others. It was bad, bad time. But just keep in mind the plague of locusts image. I would actually also say, if you've seen pictures of the Dust Bowl in the United States during the 1930s, that kind of dry, everything feels like it's about to crack because it is so dry. That's probably a useful image to keep in mind once you start to hear a description of the landscape. You will hear a considerable amount of time being devoted to discussions of fashion. For the most part, these are going to be fairly straightforward. However, there is some discussion of colors and styles that I wasn't entirely sure of. I knew that during this time period, you started to get those mutton chop sleeves on the women, the big, big poofy sleeves, so like their upper shoulder down to right around the bicep would just be a big poof of fabric. That's true. But Dumas goes a step further into costumes that were part of Provence. And I found some pictures. Some of them were on Pinterest. Some of them obviously are going to be art because nobody was photographing this stuff at the time. But there's some really beautiful stuff associated with this time period, both for women and men. The colors, the patterns, they're, in some respects, you'd look at it and say, well, that's very peasant-like, but not really, because a lot of this was silk. So it's worth taking a look, and I've linked out to a few places where you can see either, like I said, photographs of pieces that we still have that are extant now, as well as paintings of these costumes at the time. So that's one. There is another thing that is going to go by really quickly, and it is a mention of someone wearing a three-cornered hat. Now, this stuck out at me, and you may already be saying, wait a minute, a three-cornered hat? Aren't we in like 1830, 1840 by now? Isn't a three-cornered hat kind of Revolutionary War, late 1700s time? And you would be correct. Anyone in this book who is wearing a three-cornered hat is proving themselves to be out of fashion, significantly out of fashion. And that is supposed to telegraph information, not just to us, but telegraph information to the other characters in that chapter. The information obviously being that the person that they're talking to wearing the three-cornered hat is out of fashion, out of date, not concerned with fashion, or doesn't have enough money to participate in the fashion world. Any and all of which could be significant. So that is the important thing to listen for when it comes to the three-cornered hat. You will hear a mention of a box that is covered in shagreen. I know I have heard this before, and I think we probably have all seen it before, but I never put the two words together. This is shagreen, not chagrin. This is not a description of a feeling embarrassed. Shagreen is S-H-A-G-R-E-E-N. Sometimes it refers to shark skin that's been treated to be used as book leather. Sometimes it is a leather, a cow leather, cowhide leather, that has been treated in a way to leave it very textured and kind of bumpy. And I've linked out to pictures from the craftlit.com/419 page. But I think if you close your eyes and you think back to some of these very old books that you've seen that are bound in leather, and you think about the ones that are the most richly textured, these are ones where the top bumps, or the top of the bumps that create the texture, because of their age, have probably been worn down a little bit. And in doing that, it creates a mottled look and a multicolored look. You get a lot more variation in color than you would with a very soft leather, like a kid leather or something like that. So it's not just an expensive leather, a unique leather. It is also really interesting to look at. And my guess is, I couldn't find any proof on this, but I'm going to guess that it's a little more expensive than your regular leather. And that also will make sense very soon. 50,000 francs at the time, roughly, and this is really rough, would be about 650,000 American dollars today. Trying to do these translations in money can really take some time. But it looks like it's well over $500,000 US right now, so you could translate that back into euros from here. It's a lot of money, which I think we knew. 50,000 francs just sounds like a lot of money no matter what. But it's a dumpster load of cash is what it is. And the last thing to mention before we go into the chapter is gastroenteritis. We often refer to gastroenteritis as stomach flu. It's really usually a stomach virus. Sometimes it's caused by bacteria, often by a virus. And it's when you have the unfortunate encounter with relieving yourself from both ends of your system, often. Sometimes only one, but many times both. It is miserable and unpleasant and painful, and nobody really wants to go through that. But I don't know anybody who still calls it gastroenteritis. It's always stomach flu when I hear people talk about it. So I just wanted to remind you that it had an official name. And that's it. Let's listen to our chapter. Woo-hoo. All right, here we go. Chapter 26 of The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas. Read for us by David Clark. Enjoy.
Chapter 26. The Pont du Gard Inn. Such of my readers as have made a pedestrian excursion to the south of France may perchance have noticed, about midway between the town of Beaucaire and the village of Bellegarde, a little nearer to the former than to the latter, a small roadside inn, from the front of which hung creaking and flapping in the wind a sheet of tin covered with a grotesque representation of the Pont du Gard. This modern place of entertainment stood on the left-hand side of the post-road, and backed upon the Rhône. It also boasted of what in Languedoc is styled a garden, consisting of a small plot of ground, on the side opposite to the main entrance reserved for the reception of guests. A few dingy olives and stunted fig trees struggled hard for existence, but their withered, dusty foliage abundantly proved how unequal was the conflict. Between these sickly shrubs grew a scanty supply of garlic, tomatoes, and échalots, while, lone and solitary, like a forgotten sentinel, a tall pine raised its melancholy head in one of the corners of this unattractive spot, and displayed its flexible stem and fan-shaped summit dried and cracked by the fierce heat of the subtropical sun. In the surrounding plain, which more resembled a dusty lake than solid ground, were scattered a few miserable stalks of wheat, the effect, no doubt, of a curious desire on the part of the agriculturists of the country to see whether such a thing as the raising of grain in those parched regions was practicable. Each stalk served as a perch for a grasshopper, which regaled the passers-by through this Egyptian scene with its strident, monotonous note. For about 7 or 8 years, the little tavern had been kept by a man and his wife with two servants, a chambermaid named Trinette, and a hostler called Picot. This small staff was quite equal to all the requirements, for a canal between Beaucaire and Aigues-Mortes had revolutionised transportation by substituting boats for the cart and the stagecoach. And as though to add to the daily misery which this prosperous canal inflicted on the unfortunate innkeeper, whose utter ruin it was fast accomplishing, it was situated between the Rhône, from which it had its source, and the post road it had depleted, not 100 steps from the inn, of which we've given a brief but faithful description. The innkeeper himself was a man of from 40 to 45 years of age, tall, strong and bony, a perfect specimen of the natives of those southern latitudes. He had dark, sparkling and deep-set eyes, hooked nose, and teeth white as those of a carnivorous animal. His hair, like his beard, which he wore under his chin, was thick and curly, and in spite of his age, but slightly interspersed with a few silvery threads. His naturally dark complexion had assumed a still further shade of brown from the habit the unfortunate man had acquired of stationing himself from morning till eve at the threshold of his door, on the lookout for guests, who seldom came, yet there he stood, day after day, exposed to the meridional rays of a burning sun, with no other protection for his head than a red handkerchief twisted around it, after the manner of the Spanish muleteers. This man was our old acquaintance, Gaspard Caderousse. His wife, on the contrary, whose maiden name had been Madeleine Radel, was pale, meagre, and sickly-looking. Born in the neighbourhood of Arles, she had shared in the beauty for which its women are proverbial. But that beauty had gradually withered beneath the devastating influence of the slow fever so prevalent among dwellers by the ponds of Aigues-Mortes and the marshes of Camargue. She remained nearly always in her second-floor chamber, shivering in her chair or stretched languid and feeble on her bed, while her husband kept his daily watch at the door, a duty he performed with so much the greater willingness as it saved him the necessity of listening to the endless plaints and murmurs of his helpmate, who never saw him without breaking out into bitter invectives against fate, to all of which her husband would calmly return an unvarying reply in these philosophic words,
"Hush, la carconte, it is God's pleasure that things should be so."
The sobriquet of La Carconte had been bestowed on Madeleine Radel from the fact that she had been born in a village, so called, situated between Salon and Lambesc. And as a custom existed among the inhabitants of that part of France, where Caderousse lived, of styling every person by some particular and distinctive appellation, her husband had bestowed on her the name of La Carconte, in place of her sweet and euphonious name of Madeleine, which in all probability his rude guttural language would not have enabled him to pronounce. Still, let it not be supposed that amid this affected resignation to the will of Providence, the unfortunate innkeeper did not writhe under the double misery of seeing the hateful canal carry off his customers and his profits, and the daily infliction of his peevish partner's murmurs and lamentations. Like other dwellers in the south, he was a man of sober habits and moderate desires, but fond of external show, vain and addicted to display. During the days of his prosperity, not a festivity took place without himself and wife being among the spectators. He dressed in the picturesque costume worn upon grand occasions by the inhabitants of the south of France, bearing equal resemblance to the style adopted both by the Catalan and the Andalusians, while La Carconte displayed the charming fashion prevalent among the women of Arles, a mode of attire borrowed equally from Greece and Arabia. But by degrees, watch chains, necklaces, parti-coloured scarves, embroidered bodices, velvet vests, elegantly worked stockings, striped gaiters and silver buckles for the shoes all disappeared, and Gaspard Caderousse, unable to appear abroad in his pristine splendour, had given up any further participation in the pomps and vanities, both for himself and wife, although a bitter feeling of envious discontent filled his mind as the sound of mirth and merry music from the joyous revellers reached even the miserable hostelry to which he still clung, more for the shelter than the profit it afforded. Caderousse, then, was as usual at his place of observation before the door, his eyes glancing listlessly from a piece of the closely shaven grass, on which some fowls were industriously, though fruitlessly, endeavouring to turn up some grain or insect suited to their palate, to the deserted road, which led away to the north and south, when he was aroused by the shrill voice of his wife, and grumbling to himself as he went, he mounted to her chamber, first taking care, however, to set the entrance door wide open as an invitation to any chance traveller who might be passing. At the moment Caderousse quitted his sentry-like watch before the door, the road on which he so eagerly strained his sight was void and lonely as a desert at midday. There it lay, stretching out into one interminable line of dust and sand, with its sides bordered by tall, meagre trees, altogether presenting so uninviting an appearance that no one in his senses could have imagined that any traveller, at liberty to regulate his hours for journeying, would choose to expose himself in such a formidable Sahara. Nevertheless, had Caderousse but retained his post a few minutes longer, he might have caught a dim outline of something approaching from the direction of Bellegarde. As the moving object drew nearer, he would easily have perceived that it consisted of a man and horse, between whom the kindest and most amiable understanding appeared to exist. The horse was of Hungarian breed and ambled along at an easy pace. His rider was a priest, dressed in black, and wearing a three-cornered hat, and in spite of the ardent rays of a noonday sun, the pair came on with a fair degree of rapidity. Having arrived before the Pont du Gard, the horse stopped, but whether for his own pleasure or that of his rider would have been difficult to say. However, that might have been, the priest, dismounting, led his steed by the bridle in search of some place to which he could secure him. Availing himself of a handle that projected from a half-fallen door, he tied the animal safely and, having drawn a red cotton handkerchief from his pocket, wiped away the perspiration that streamed from his brow. Then, advancing to the door, struck thrice with the end of his iron-shod stick. At this unusual sound, a huge black dog came rushing to meet the daring assailant of his ordinarily tranquil abode, snarling and displaying his sharp white teeth with a determined hostility that abundantly proved how little he was accustomed to society. At that moment a heavy footstep was heard descending the wooden staircase that led from the upper floor, and with many bows and courteous smiles, mine host of the Pont du Gard besought his guest to enter.
"You are welcome, sir, most welcome," repeated the astonished Caderousse. "Now then, Margotin," cried he, speaking to the dog, "will you be quiet? Pray don't heed him, sir. He only barks, he never bites. I make no doubt a glass of good wine would be acceptable this dreadful hot day."
Then, perceiving for the first time the garb of the traveller he had to entertain, Caderousse hastily exclaimed,
"A thousand pardon. I really did not observe whom I had the honour to receive under my poor roof. What would the abbé please to have? What refreshment can I offer? All I have is at his service."
The priest gazed on the person addressing him with a long and searching gaze. There even seemed a disposition on his part to court a similar scrutiny on the part of the innkeeper. Then, observing in the countenance of the latter no other expression than extreme surprise at his own want of attention to an inquiry so courteously worded, he deemed it as well to terminate this dumb show, and therefore said, speaking with a strong Italian accent,
"You are, I presume, Monsieur Caderousse?"
"Yes, sir,"
answered the host, even more surprised at the question than he had been by the silence which had preceded it.
"I am Gaspard Caderousse, at your service."
"Gaspard Caderousse," rejoined the priest. "Yes, Christian and surname are the same. You formerly lived, I believe, in the Allée de Meillon, on the fourth floor."
"I did."
"And you followed the business of a tailor?"
"True, I was a tailor, till the trade fell off. It is so hot at Marseille that I really believe that the respectable inhabitants will in time go without any clothing whatever. But talking of heat, is there nothing I can offer you by way of refreshment?"
"Yes, sir, let me have a bottle of your best wine, and then, with your permission, we will resume our conversation from where we left off."
"As you please, sir," said Caderousse,
who, anxious not to lose the present opportunity of finding a customer for one of the few bottles of Cahors still remaining in his possession, hastily raised a trapdoor in the floor of the apartment they were in, which served both as parlour and kitchen. Upon issuing forth from his subterranean retreat at the expiration of 5 minutes, he found the abbé seated upon a wooden stool, leaning his elbow on a table, while Margotin, whose animosity seemed appeased by the unusual command of the traveller for refreshments, had crept up to him, and had established himself very comfortably between his knees, his long skinny neck resting on his lap, while his dim eye was fixed earnestly on the traveller's face.
"Are you quite alone?"
inquired the guest, as Caderousse placed before him the bottle of wine and the glass.
"Quite, quite alone," replied the man, "or at least practically so, for my poor wife, who is the only person in the house beside myself, is laid up with illness, and unable to render me the least assistance. Poor thing!"
"You are married, then?"
said the priest, with a show of interest, glancing round as he spoke at the scanty furnishings of the apartment.
"Ah, sir," said Caderousse with a sigh, "it is easy to perceive I am not a rich man. But in this world a man does not thrive the better for being honest."
the abbé fixed on him a searching, penetrating glance.
"Yes, honest. I can certainly say that much for myself," continued the innkeeper, fairly sustaining the scrutiny of the abbé's gaze. "I can boast with truth of being an honest man, and," continued he significantly with a hand on his breast and shaking his head, "that is more than everyone can say nowadays."
"So much the better for you, if what you assert be true," said the abbé.
"For I am firmly persuaded that sooner or later the good will be rewarded and the wicked punished."
"Such words as those belong to your profession," answered Caderousse,
"and you do well to repeat them. But,"
added he with a bitter expression of countenance,
"one is free to believe them or not, as one pleases."
"You are wrong to speak thus," said the abbé, "and perhaps I may, in my own person, be able to prove to you how completely you are in error."
"What mean you?"
inquired Caderousse with a look of surprise.
"In the first place, I must be satisfied that you are the person I am in search of."
"What proofs do you require?"
"Did you, in the year 1814 or 1815, know anything of a young sailor named Dante?"
"Dante? Did I know poor dear Edmond? Why, Edmond Dante and myself were intimate friends," exclaimed Caderousse,
whose countenance flushed darkly as he caught the penetrating gaze of the abbé fixed on him, while the clear, calm eye of the questioner seemed to dilate with feverish scrutiny.
"You remind me," said the priest, "that the young man concerning whom I asked you was said to bear the name of Edmond."
"Said to bear the name?" repeated Caderousse, becoming excited and eager. "Why, he was so called as truly as I myself bore the appellation of Gaspard Caderousse. But tell me, I pray, what has become of poor Edmond? Did you know him? Is he alive and at liberty? Is he prosperous and happy?"
"He died a more wretched, hopeless, heartbroken prisoner than the felons who pay the penalty of their crimes at the galleys of Toulon."
A deadly pallor followed the flush on the countenance of Caderousse, who turned away, and the priest saw him wiping the tears from his eyes with the corner of the red handkerchief twisted round his head.
"Poor fellow, poor fellow," murmured Caderousse. "Well there, sir, is another proof that good people are never rewarded on this earth, and that none but the wicked prosper. Oh,"
continued Caderousse, speaking in the highly coloured language of the South,
"the world grows worse and worse. Why does not God, if he really hates the wicked, as he said he do, send down brimstone and fire and consume them altogether?"
"You speak as though you had loved this young Dante," observed the abbé,
without taking any notice of his companion's vehemence.
"And so I did," replied Caderousse, "though once, I confess, I envied him his good fortune. But I swear to you, sir, I swear to you by everything a man holds dear, I have since then deeply and sincerely lamented his unhappy fate."
There was a brief silence, during which the fixed, searching eye of the abbé was employed in scrutinizing the agitated features of the innkeeper.
"You knew the poor lad, then?" continued Caderousse.
"I was called to see him on his dying bed, that I might administer to him the consolations of religion."
"And of what did he die?"
asked Caderousse in a choking voice.
"Of what, think you? Do young and strong men die in prison, when they have scarcely numbered their 30th year, unless it be of imprisonment?"
Caderousse wiped away the large beads of perspiration that gathered on his brow.
"But the strangest part of the story is," resumed the abbé, "that Dante, even in his dying moments, swore by his crucified Redeemer that he was utterly ignorant of the cause of his detention."
"And so he was," murmured Caderousse. "How should he have been otherwise? Oh, sir, the poor fellow told you the truth.
And for that reason, he besought me to try and clear up a mystery he had never been able to penetrate, and to clear his memory should any foul spot or stain have fallen on it.
And here, the look of the abbe, becoming more and more fixed, seemed to rest with ill-concealed satisfaction on the gloomy depression which was rapidly spreading over the countenance of Caderousse.
"A rich Englishman," continued the abbe, "who had been his companion in misfortune, but had been released from prison during the Second Restoration, was possessed of a diamond of immense value. This jewel he bestowed on Dante upon himself, quitting the prison, as a mark of his gratitude for the kindness and brotherly care with which Dante had nursed him in a severe illness he underwent during his confinement. Instead of employing this diamond in attempting to bribe his jailers, who might only have taken it and then betrayed him to the governor, Dante carefully preserved it, that in the event of his getting out of prison, he might have wherewithal to live, for the sale of such a diamond would have quite sufficed to make his fortune."
"Then I suppose," asked Caderousse with eager glowing looks, "that it was a stone of immense value."
"Why, everything is a relative," answered the abbe. "To one in Edmond's position, the diamond certainly was of great value. It was estimated at 50,000 francs.
"Bless me!" exclaimed Caderousse. 50,000 francs! Surely the diamond was as large as a nut to be worth all that."
"No," replied the abbe, "it was not of such a size as that. But you shall judge for yourself. I have it with me."
The sharp gaze of Caderousse was instantly directed towards the priest's garments, as though hoping to discover the location of the treasure. Calmly drawing forth from his pocket a small box covered with black shagreen, the abbe opened it and displayed to the dazzled eyes of Caderousse the sparkling jewel it contained, set in a ring of admirable workmanship.
"And that diamond!" cried Caderousse, almost breathless with eager admiration. "You say it's worth 50,000 francs?
"It is, without the setting, which is also valuable," replied the abbe, as he closed the box and returned it to his pocket,
while its brilliant hues seemed still to dance before the eyes of the fascinated innkeeper.
"But how comes the diamond in your possession, sir? Did Edmond make you his heir?"
"No, I'm merely his testamentary executor. I once possessed 4 dear and faithful friends, besides the maiden to whom I was betrothed," he said, "and I feel convinced they have all unfeignedly grieved over my loss. The name of one of the 4 friends is Caderousse."
The innkeeper shivered.
"Another of the number,"
continued the abbe, without seeming to notice the emotion of Caderousse,
"is called Danglars, and the 3rd, in spite of being my rival, entertained a very sincere affection for me."
A fiendish smile played over the features of Caderousse, who was about to break in upon the abbe's speech, when the latter, waving his hand, said,
"Allow me to finish first, and then, if you have any observations to make, you can do so afterwards. The 3rd of my friends, although my rival, was much attached to me. His name was Fernand. That of the betrothed was... Stay, continued the abbe. I have forgotten what he called her."
"Mercedes," said Caderousse eagerly.
"True," said the abbe with a stifled sigh. "Mercedes it was."
"Go on," urged Caderousse.
"Bring me a carafe of water," said the abbe.
Caderousse quickly performed the stranger's bidding, and after pouring some into a glass and slowly swallowing its contents, the abbe resumed his usual placidity of manner, said as he placed his empty glass on the table,
"Where did we leave off?"
"The name of Edmond's betrothed was Mercedes."
"To be sure. You will go to Marseille," said Dante, "for you understand, I repeat his words just as he uttered them. Do you understand?"
"Perfectly."
"You will sell this diamond. You will divide the money into 5 equal parts,
and give an equal portion to those good friends, the only persons who have loved me upon earth."
"But why into 5 parts?" asked Caderousse. "You only mentioned 4 persons.
"Because the 5th is dead, as I hear. The 5th sharer is Edmond's bequest, was his own father."
"Too true, too true," ejaculated Caderousse, almost suffocated by the contending passions which assailed him. "The poor old man, he did die."
"I learned so much at Marseilles," replied the abbé, making a strong effort to appear indifferent. "But from the length of time that has elapsed since the death of the elder Dante, I was unable to obtain any particular of his end. Can you enlighten me on that point?"
"I do not know. Who could, if I could not?" said Caderousse. "Why, I lived almost on the same floor with the poor old man. Ah, yes, about 1 year after the disappearance of his son, the poor old man died."
"Of what did he die?"
"Why, the doctors called his complaint gastroenteritis, I believe. His acquaintances say he died of grief. But I, who saw him in his dying moments, I say he died of..."
Caderousse paused.
"Of what?" asked the priest anxiously and eagerly.
"Why, of downright starvation."
"Starvation?" exclaimed the abbé, springing from his seat. "Why, the vilest animals are not suffered to die by such a death as that. The very dogs that wander houseless and homeless in the streets find some pitying hand to cast them a mouthful of bread. And that a man, a Christian, should be allowed to perish of hunger in the midst of other men who call themselves Christians is too horrible for belief. Oh, it is impossible, utterly impossible."
"What I have said," answered Caderousse.
"And you are a fool for having said anything about it," said a voice from the top of the stairs. "Why should you meddle with what does not concern you?"
The 2 men turned quickly and saw the sickly countenance of La Carconte peering between the baluster rails. Attracted by the sound of voices, she had feebly dragged herself down the stairs, and seated on the lower step, head on knees, she had listened to the foregoing conversation.
"Mind your own business, wife," replied Caderousse sharply. "This gentleman asked me for information which common politeness will not permit me to refuse."
"Politeness! You simpleton!" retorted La Carconte. "What have you to do with politeness? I should like to know. Better study a little common prudence. How do you know the motives that person may have for trying to extract all he can from you?"
"I pledge you my word, madame," said the abbé, "that my intentions are good, and that your husband can incur no risk, providing he answers me candidly."
"Ah, that's all very fine," retorted the woman. "Nothing is easier than to begin with fair promises and assurances of nothing to fear. But when poor, silly folks like my husband there have been persuaded to tell all they know, the promises and assurances of safety are quickly forgotten, and at some moment, when nobody is expecting it, behold, trouble and misery and all sorts of persecutions are heaped on the unfortunate wretches who cannot even see whence all their afflictions come."
"Nay, nay, my good woman, make yourself perfectly easy, I beg of you. Whatever evils may befall you, they will not be occasioned by my instrumentality, that I solemnly promise you."
La Carconte muttered a few inarticulate words, then let her head again drop upon her knees, and went into a fit of ague, leaving the 2 speakers to resume the conversation, but remaining so as to be able to hear every word they uttered. Again, the abbé had been obliged to swallow a draught of water to calm the emotions that threatened to overpower him. When he had sufficiently recovered himself, he said,
"It appears, then, that the miserable old man you were telling me of was forsaken by everyone. Surely, had not such been the case, he would not have perished by so dreadful a death."
"Why, he was not altogether forsaken," continued Caderousse, "for Messeres, the Catalan, and Monsieur Morel were very kind to him. But somehow the poor old man
had contracted a profound hatred for Fernand, the very person, added Caderousse with a bitter smile, that you named just now as being one of Dante's faithful and attached friends.
And was he not so? Asked the abbé.
Gaspar! Gaspar!
Murmured the woman from her seat on the stairs.
Mind what you are saying!
Caderousse made no reply to these words, though evidently irritated and annoyed by the interruption, but addressing the abbé said,
Can a man be faithful to another whose wife he covets and desires for himself? But Dante was so honourable and true in his own nature that he believed everybody's professions of friendship. Poor Edmond! He was cruelly deceived, but it was fortunate that he never knew, or he might have found it more difficult when on his deathbed to pardon his enemies. And whatever people may say, continued Caderousse in his native language, which was not altogether devoid of rude poetry, I cannot help being more frightened at the idea of the malediction of the dead man than the hatred of the living.
Imbecile!
Exclaimed La Carconte.
Do you then know in what manner Fernand injured Dante? Inquired the abbé of Caderousse.
Do I? No one better.
Speak out, then. Say what it was.
Gaspar!
Cried La Carconte.
Do as you will. You are master. But if you take my advice, you'll hold your tongue.
Well, wife, replied Caderousse, I don't know but what you're right.
So you will say nothing? Asked the abbé.
Why, what good would it do? Asked Caderousse. If the poor lad were leaving and came to me and begged that I would candidly tell which were his true and which his false friends, why, perhaps I should not hesitate. But you tell me he is no more, and therefore can have nothing to do with hatred or revenge. So let all such feeling be buried with him.
You prefer, then, said the abbé, that I should bestow on men, you say, are false and treacherous, the reward intended for faithful friendship.
That is true enough, returned Caderousse.
You say truly, the gift of poor Edmond was not meant for such traitors as Fernand and Danglars. Besides, what will it be to them? No more than a drop of water in the ocean.
Remember, chimed in La Carconte, those two could crush you at a single blow.
How so? Inquired the abbé. Are these persons then so rich and powerful?
Do you not know their history?
I do not. Pray relate it to me.
Caderousse seemed to reflect for a few moments, then said,
No, truly it would take up too much time.
Well, my good friend, returned the abbé in a tone that indicated utter indifference on his part, you are at liberty either to speak or be silent, just as you please. For my own part, I respect your scruples and admire your sentiments, so let the matter end. I shall do my duty as conscientiously as I can, and fulfil my promise to the dying man. My first business will be to dispose of this diamond.
So saying, the abbé again drew the small box from his pocket, opened it, and contrived to hold it in such a light that a bright flash of brilliant hues passed before the dazzled gaze of Caderousse.
"Wife! Wife!" cried he in a hoarse voice. "Come here!"
"Diamond!"
exclaimed La Carconte, rising and descending to the chamber with a tolerably firm step.
"What diamond are you talking about?"
"Why, did you not hear all we said?" inquired Caderousse. "It is a beautiful diamond, left by poor Edmond Dante, to be sold, and the money divided between his father, Mercedes, his betrothed bride, Fernand, Danglars, and myself. The jewel is worth at least 50,000 francs."
"Oh, what a magnificent jewel!"
cried the astonished woman.
"The fifth part of the profits from this stone belong to us, then. Does it not?" asked Caderousse.
"It does," replied the abbé, "with the addition of an equal division of that part intended for the elder Dante, which I believe myself at liberty to divide equally with the four survivors."
"And why among us four?"
inquired Caderousse.
as being the friends Edmond esteemed most faithful and devoted to him. "I don't call those friends who betray and ruin you," murmured the wife in her turn in a low, muttering voice. "Of course not," rejoined Caderousse quickly. "No more do I, and that was what I was observing to this gentleman just now. I said I looked upon it as a sacrilegious profanation to reward treachery, perhaps crime."
"Remember," answered the abbé calmly, as he replaced the jewel and its case in the pocket of his cassock, "it is your fault, not mine, that I do so. You will have the goodness to furnish me with the address of both Fernand and Danglars, in order that I may execute Edmond's last wishes." The agitation of Caderousse became extreme, and large drops of perspiration rolled from his heated brow. As he saw the abbé rise from his seat and go towards the door, as though to ascertain if his horse were sufficiently refreshed to continue his journey, Caderousse and his wife exchanged looks of deep meaning.
"There, you see, wife," said the former, "this splendid diamond might all be ours, if we choose."
"Do you believe it?"
"Why, surely a man of his holy profession would not deceive us."
"Well," replied La Carconte, "do as you like. For my part, I wash my hands of the fair."
So saying, she once more climbed the staircase leading to her chamber, her body convulsed with chills, and her teeth rattling in her head, in spite of the intense heat of the weather. Arrived at the top stair, she turned around and called out in a warning tone to her husband,
"Gaspard, consider well what you are about to do."
"I have both reflected and decided," answered he.
La Carconte then entered her chamber, the flooring of which creaked beneath her heavy, uncertain tread, as she proceeded towards her armchair, into which she fell as though exhausted.
"Well," asked the abbé as he returned to the apartment below, "what have you made up your mind to do?"
"To tell you all I know,"
was the reply. "I certainly think you act wisely in so doing," said the priest. "Not because I have the least desire to learn anything you may please to conceal from me, but simply that it, through your assistance, I should distribute the legacy, according to the wishes of the testator. Why, so much the better, that is all."
"I hope it may be so,"
replied Caderousse, his face flushed with cupidity.
"I am all attention," said the abbé.
"Stop a minute," answered Caderousse. "We might be interrupted in the most interesting part of my story, which would be a pity, and it is as well that your visit either should be made known only to ourselves."
With these words he went stealthily to the door, which he closed, and by way of still greater precaution, bolted and barred it, as he was accustomed to do at night. During this time the abbé had chosen his place for listening at his ease. He removed his seat into a corner of the room, where he himself would be in deep shadow, while the light would be fully thrown on the narrator. Then, with head bent down and hands clasped, or rather clinched together, he prepared to give his whole attention to Caderousse, who seated himself on the little stool exactly opposite to him.
"Remember, this is no affair of mine,"
said the trembling voice of La Carconte, as though through the flooring of her chamber she viewed the scene that was enacting below.
"Enough, enough," replied Caderousse. "Say no more about it. I would take all the consequences upon myself."
And he began his story. End of chapter 26.
Don't hate me. Don't hate me for stopping there. I know, that was so hard. I had a hard time not going on. Oh, come on. But I couldn't this week. But next week is going to be great, right? Because we're going to hear all of Caderousse's story. And we heard quite a bit already. And La Carconte, wow, she is really not wanting Caderousse to talk about this stuff. And why? Why should she care? All of this happened before he married her. So something's going on there. And we might find out about that next week. But Pont du Gard, the inn that Caderousse is running the sad, sad, sad little inn. Its sign outside is a painting on that metal sheet of the Pont du Gard, which just is a fabulous juxtaposition in ridiculousness of having this incredible edifice representing this sad, sad little inn that's just falling apart and looks like a scene from the Egyptian plagues where the stalks of grass are brown and parched and dying and the cicadas are sitting there going and that's all you can hear. It's kind of that sound effect that they use on radio shows and podcasts now. When somebody asks a question and all you hear is crickets chirping because nobody has a response, that's Caderousse's place right now. So that was just Dumas throwing in a little humor for you. And you understand how this inn of Caderousse's is failing, right? This is what happened in the United States when the interstate system was put through and all of the state roads were bypassed. So anyone who had had a thriving business on Route 66, for example, would have had all of that traffic that used to drive by, see their restaurant or their hotel or their inn, and then stop and, you know, spend their money there. But if the interstate has removed all of the traffic from that location and put them A, into a place where they're going by faster, and B, into a place where they are further away from seeing the mom and pop stores, you are going to make it very unlikely that anyone will leave the interstate to backtrack to the little diner that they saw or the little roadside inn that they saw. And thus, these places went out of business. This is part of what the Disney Pixar movie Cars was about, actually, the original, the first one. And it's certainly something that I've seen in my life as when I was a kid, we drove along many state roads as well as interstates. In my travels back and forth across the country with my kids, it's something that we saw then too. So Caderousse is like the little roadside inn that has been bypassed by an interstate. In this case, the interstate is a canal. And why would you stop? If you are on a barge that's getting towed along, you're making good time. The numbers of people who would time out at a point where, ooh, let's stay at this inn, it's probably smaller. And it doesn't sound like he has anything like a dock or any way of attracting people off of the canal. So he's kind of stuck. And he's also stuck with his wife. So Le Cocon, it sounds like she probably has malaria. And I think Dumas says as much, that she grew up in an area near swamps and bogs and things like that. And that sounds to me like mosquitoes and malaria, which would be miserable because there's nothing you could do. And so she is actually and in fact physically miserable and has now become a miserable person to be around. It doesn't sound like she was always like that, which is kind of sad that now they're in this frustrating cycle. And poor Caderousse, I think he wants to be Thénardier, the master of the house in Les Mis, but Caderousse isn't even good enough to be that bad. He's just kind of sad, and you just kind of feel sorry for him. But boy, did you see his eyes light up when he saw the diamond. There's a line where his face is flushed with cupidity, and cupidity is greed, material greed for things, usually things. I think we start to see some important information on Caderousse when we see his response to the diamond. And of course, Le Carcant also is like, what? Diamond? What? Oh, okay, well, do what you want then. She's so charming. So the diamond is referred to as being worth 50,000 francs. And we know it's very hard to do money translation, but my best guess is that this would have been somewhere roughly around $650,000 US today. So you can translate out from that. It's like $500,000 or $500,000 francs at the time. And again, you know, we know that the translation of money is affected by the marketplace as well. For example, 50,000 francs would have been able to buy you a lot of human labor and not quite so much in the way of furniture and things like that. Remember, this is still, like we had with Jane Austen, people are cheap, things are expensive. Regardless, $500,000 can buy you quite a lot today, and it would have been able to buy you quite a lot back then as well. And even though Caderousse has not begun his official story, we have picked up on a lot of information. Now, one of the things that I haven't mentioned yet, but that you have probably picked up on already, is that young Edmond is now the Abbé Busconi and is speaking with an Italian accent and is wearing an unfashionable three-cornered hat and riding a Hungarian horse. And what's up with all of that? I'm not going to tell you. No, it's the true beginning of our international man of mystery. We've already seen Edmond go off and buy a boat, buy his yacht, in a way that seems rather mysterious. We've seen him as sort of not himself, but also not really anybody else yet, go in and find out where his father was living, if his father was still living there, going over and visiting the Catalans to talk to them for a while. He's rewarded the kind people who he spoke to in these places, and he never really revealed his hand in that he never seems to tell anybody who he actually is. But we've taken it a step further now. He has an entire persona that is not based at all in reality, with the possible exception that he's apparently basing his Abbé Busconi on Abbé Faria. Beyond that, there's no reality. But he's using this disguise rather well to get Caderousse to open up to him. And when the fact of being a man of the cloth isn't enough, then he whips out the diamond. This is some of that marvelous giving people enough rope to hang themselves with that Edmond must have known somewhat, but because he is now so much more worldly in his interactions with other people, he's well aware, or he seems to be well aware, of what Caderousse's weaknesses were and are, and avarice seems to be one of those things. So he's going to take advantage of that, if he can, if he needs to. Otherwise, the other thing that becomes really clear about Caderousse is he's basically just a kind of a nice schlub. Yeah, he's greedy, and yeah, if something comes along that lets him buy nice clothes and show off for a while and be the master of the house, Caderousse is right in there. He is happy to do that and be that guy. But that isn't evil. And that isn't Danglars or de Villefort. That's just a guy of questionable compass. It's not even necessarily moral compass. It's not like a moral failing. He's just not ever going to be much. And again, that's where giving a guy enough rope to hang himself with probably is a really good MO for how to go about punishing them. Because I think we can all agree that we know that somewhere in here, Edmond, now Abbé Busconi, is going to make sure that Caderousse is at least somewhat punished for his part in the destruction of Edmond Dantès. We've heard a little bit of Caderousse's story, enough to whet our appetite. So next week, we get Caderousse's story. Very exciting stuff. It is one of those things that I didn't realize I had been waiting for, but boy, was I waiting for it. So lots of fun coming your way. And a quick thank you to everyone who has voted for Craftlit in the People's Choice Podcast Awards. I know this is a complete and utter annoyance to have to vote every day, to have everything count, but there have been millions of votes cast for the various podcasts that are up for awards, and almost 400,000 unique visits. 400,000 unique podcast listeners going to that site to vote for the podcast they love. To say that having been nominated for this award is important is to minimize it far too much. If you had an hour to waste, you could have watched the video where the guy who's hosting the podcast award explains all the different criteria that were used. And it really made me happy because so many of the changes that I've made to the website over the years, or changes that I've made to the way that the podcast is distributed and how it looks when it shows up on your iPhone screen or your iPod screen, those things have come from you. I didn't come up with any of the good stuff. You guys came up with all of that. And that turns out to have been some of the criteria that the judges judged by in the first round. If shows didn't have a website, if shows didn't have an RSS feed available, if shows didn't have an obvious way to listen to the podcast, if there wasn't some kind of how to listen or who we are or contact, all of these things eliminated other shows from the running. And so Craftlit winds up being one of the 10 left, not only because of having an active and engaged audience, but because you have pushed Craftlit to be better and better all the time. So thank you. And thank you for voting. Voting ends at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or Eastern Daylight Time, on Sunday, this Sunday, the 12th. So if you can vote a few more times, thank you. And if you can convince, you know, everyone you know to go and vote for Craftlit as well, that would be nifty too. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much, and I'll talk to you next week. Take care. Bye.
If you like getting free audiobooks with benefits every week, please consider supporting the show over at patreon.com/craftlit. There are rewards waiting for you beyond, you know, the free podcast. You can also subscribe to our premium streaming audio by tapping the red lock when you are looking at the app or at the show notes at craftlit.libsyn.com/podcast. You can also sign up for a premium download subscription by following the links in the right-hand sidebar at craftlit.com. And if it's easier for you, you can always subscribe and review at iTunes and at Stitcher Radio. Like us on Facebook, support us at Patreon, and come with us on tour. For 9 years, Craftlit has been kept going by the support of you, the listener. And for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.